You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face, incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people. Hello, hello, hello. Out there in YouTube and podcast land, you have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift and or separate them from the average genre fare. Are you new to us? Well, if you are, David and I are friends that have been talking about movies for centuries. No, that's not quite right, but it seems like that way sometimes.
Feels like it.
Let's say we've been talking about movies that have existed over the last century. Mm-hmm. That would probably be more appropriate. David is more of a sci-fi fan. I'm more of a horror movie fan. So we kind of alternate pretty much, unless we got something special going on. And we deep dive into a movie every week, 40 weeks a year. Those of you that have returned, well, you already know this. And you know how important it is to like, rate, and comment on these videos and or podcasts. And if you really like us, you can always hop over to Patreon and sponsor one of our other shows over there.
Yes.
I am Tim. I am here with my good friend David. David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Yeah, except I can't get my virtual background to work. So this is my real background.
Oh, my God. Look. Yes. You don't have a virtual background. That's weird that you're in an office.
It's very odd to actually be in an office context this time, sort of.
Especially for the topic.
Yeah. But and interesting that I'm what I've been doing. We usually start with genre week. What have you done genre related in this past week kind of thing since we last spoke? And in, you know, keeping with the lovely way we try to classify things and do deep dives and examinations and impressions and keys and key influences and things like that, I saw an article and was reading it, and it was a bunch of, it actually had four different writers. I think it was on Collider, and had four different authors talking about Black Mirror and putting Black Mirror in hierarchy. You know, these are the top five episodes. These are the middle five. These are the lower five, whatever. You know,
yeah, we've never done that here.
And I was thinking, I've never done that. So I have begun my rewatch of Black Mirror to kind of categorize them and classify them and everything else. And once I finish it, I'll give you the report. But I'm just now into season two and finishing it up. I still think, you know, sad to say, I still think it's one of those where the first season was the best, second season was a little weaker, third season was a little weaker, and, you know, and gradually down. And you know how I feel about the last season. We're not even doing science fiction anymore. We just decided we'd jump over to horror
werewolves and
play with that. And yeah, werewolves and stuff.
And
so that's basically what I've been doing. And that's going to take me a couple of more weeks, I think, to finish off the entire series.
Oh, great. So you're going to be talking about this for several episodes.
No, I'll probably, you know, intermittently do something else next, you know, and talk about it next week, maybe.
Okay.
But I'll finish this out and then give my report of the top ones. I do know that once I get there, I can't remember it right now, but once I get there, the one with the astronauts in the last one, I think I would elevate to probably in my top, you know, 10 at least sort of thing. It's one of the few in the last season that I actually liked. So I do know it's going to jump up there, but we'll see. And I, again, agree that I don't think they should have started with the first episode that they started with the whole kidnapping and tell them, you know, pig sex and all of that one. I think that was a little much for the world to handle on the very first pilot episode.
I don't remember that. And I think I saw the first season.
It's all about social media, the power of social media, and modern, quote, journalism, so to speak. And remember, the prime minister of London, his daughter is kidnapped. They're not going to release her unless he has sex with a live pig on camera live.
I do. Okay, I think I do remember that.
That was the whole constraint of it, is the manipulation of social media and public outcry and blah, 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 blah. And I think the commentary is really good. I think the performances in it are great, but it's kind of out there for a first episode. You know, you might want to hook me first on some other stuff and then you can go there.
Crazy British people.
Those crazy British people. But yeah, that's what
a UK series originally, wasn't it?
Yep. First two seasons are UK, then Netflix got it.
Yeah.
So, and what about you? What, speaking of horror and horrible, bad horror?
Speaking of horror, season, I contracted something.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I contracted a little film called Contracted.
Oh, okay. I've never even heard of this. And that's a disgusting poster. Oh my gosh. Don't talk to this woman. She's obviously not feeling well.
I immediately gravitated to this poster because I was like, ooh, zombie.
or contagion of some kind, obviously.
Right. This is a little low budget movie from 2013. It's, even though it's low budget, the acting is pretty solid in it, and it's a very effective body horror movie with evidence, as you see in the poster behind me. Mm-hmm. The cast, as I said, is good, especially the lead. Her name is Nahara Townsend, but it also stars Caroline Williams, who was in Renfield and Days of Thunder, and Matt Murder, who went on to Contracted 2. Yes, there is a sequel. which I have not seen. The synopsis is, after being drugged and raped at a party, one of those roofie scenarios where mm-hmm. a woman is date raped, a young woman contracts what she thinks is an STD, but it's actually something much worse. And we gradually get to see how bad it gets. If I had to describe it, I would say she's basically a zombie, but still alive, because teeth start falling out. She's on the toilet, with lots of blood. Her eyes start, one gets cloudy, one gets red. Some of the makeup's a little out there. As a matter of fact, they could have restrained. It almost goes into cartoon land at one point. But it's still a pretty decent movie. It only gets 50% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
I would give it at least a 65 as far as a low budget horror movie. I think it's better than some. So anyway, that is what I did in my genre week. I contracted a little infection.
You did. That's, I don't know. It sounds kind of interesting. Like I might at least watch it, but I don't know. Body horror is not my favorite subgenre.
No, I would consider it for the podcast. I would. I would probably go toward David Cronenberg first, just because he's so much better at it with bigger
budgets. I would love to see his new one. I haven't seen it yet. The latest one with, where he went back to body horror, everyone was talking about it.
It's the one with Viggo Mortensen.
And they say
I can't remember the name of it. I get him and his son confused. His son did that Infinity Pool movie with Skarsgård, and then Mortensen's in the new.
Oh yeah, Infinity Pool's the other one that I haven't seen.
Yeah,
but horror wise, but
I've only seen one of his son's movies. I can't. It's called Possessor, and it was good. So mm-hmm. I would watch Infinity Pool, but I feel like I've not seen a David Cronenberg movie in a very long time. As a matter of fact, Mortensen's been in several, hadn't he? At least two or three.
Well, I do think he likes him. He was in The History mm-hmm. of Violence, and he was in this newest one. I think there was a third one, yes.
I think there was a third, too.
Pretty sure. There's no segue out of that into the Fountain of Eternal Youth futuristic one we're delving into today. I mean,
but it is our third viewer listener request episode.
Oh, it is. Yes,
it is. This one was recommended by a young man that we've known for a little while named Buck Allum. And we would like to appreciate his suggesting this feature for us today. I had not seen it in a very long time.
Yes, Buck Allum, thank you so much. And I'm curious to see. So once we do it and you listen or watch this entire episode, let us know what you think, since it's your pick sort of thing. And everybody else, let us know too what you think as we deep dive into the future of the world as seen through the eyes of William F. Nolan and
George Clayton Johnson.
George Clayton Johnson. We know both of those names from Star Trek, the original series. As a matter of fact, I think, didn't Clayton Johnson do the...
Didn't he do Where No Man's Gone Before, maybe?
I don't know if it was Where No Man's Gone Before or if it was Salt Vampire, the...
Man-Trap.
Man-Trap. I think it was Man-Trap. Pretty maybe. Sure. It was the first aired episode, and he directed it. He actually, speaking...
He
before
didn't
we
direct
digress,
it, though, did he? He just wrote it.
He wrote
it.
Yeah. Wrote it. He wrote the original and wrote this one. Speaking of which, doing some research on this, because I'm like you, I had not seen this movie in decades, kind of thing. And
you haven't said what it is.
well, we're doing Logan's Run, a little film from 1976. I have to say that so Tim can flip his picture to the title, the poster.
Well, I think people would like to know what we're talking about.
Well, hopefully they saw it in the title. I'm just saying. That's why they clicked on it. But anyway, we're doing Logan's Run. We're doing sci-fi. It's going to be, you're going to love it. But I did find in research that he had written like a series of like four or five expansion novels to this, whether they became a movie or a novel or whatever. So I thought that was interesting. One was like Jessica's Run.
There are a bunch, because when I was looking, you know, I've been trying to read a lot of our stuff this year before we do them, because you picked a lot of novels. And yes. I had trouble locating this book in a library or anywhere. But when you go on Amazon, there's a bunch of them, a bunch of sequels and stuff.
I think both he and Nolan were trying to jumpstart. He in particular, I know, was trying to jumpstart and into a franchise up until his death, actually, which was just a few years ago. So that was his kind of goal, is to take this and do it. Let's go back. Had you read the novel before you originally saw this film?
No, I think we discussed that. I didn't really realize this was based on a novel. I thought that what I always saw was a novelization of the movie. Mm-hmm. So when you said that you had picked movies based on novels this season, I went and did some research and was shocked to find out that it was a novel. And as you said, now has many sequels. It was William F. Nolan, who has been popping up a lot with us this season. Mm-hmm. Most recently, he did the screenplay for Burnt Offerings. But he's a sci-fi writer I used to see at horror conventions all the time back in the 90s.
Yeah, he was big into fans. And helping them and working with them and everything. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he died in 2019. He was from, I think, either Seattle or Oregon. He was a West Coaster, Northwestern, Westerner. Yeah.
Well, I'm fairly certain I saw this in the theater. I seem to remember it, seeing it in the theater at the time and being like, wow, you know, I was at the right age to be enamored with the costuming of this film, of course, and Jenny Agutter in general. But, you know, as a sci-fi fan, everything else, had to go see it. It had some good press and marketing, future setting, all of that. But then I went back later and read the novel, and it's striking the differences, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, later on. But there's a lot of differences between the novel and this film and the adaptation that they did. Mm-hmm. But in brief, the year is 2274, supposedly, in the film, not the novel. The remnants of civilization live in a sealed city contained beneath a cluster of geodesic domes. They have a very hedonistic lifestyle. Everything's love and happiness and sex and everything else. Once a day, I'm assuming, because it would happen every day, the group goes that is living in this giant mall goes to Carousel. And in Carousel, you go there when your life clock flashes, and you have the option of renewal. And renewal is the possibility of coming back and essentially their version.
It's like a giant lottery.
Yep. It is. And you wear masks, you float up into the heavens, and you're disintegrated.
You explode.
Yes. And everyone cheers and loves this.
Yay! Through this, Renew!
Yay, Renew! And through this, we also get to meet Sandman, named Logan, and his friend Francis. Sandmen are our policemen of this society. They actually search for runners, which are people who choose not to seek renewal in Carousel and think they want to live forever, because at 30, you have to die. Your life clock starts flashing, time for you to go, sort of thing. So the story follows Logan and Francis as they gleefully chase some runners and shoot them and get rid of them, and then report back to their computer masters, overlords, in the Sandman headquarters. During one of these times, Logan is given a special assignment that he has to follow an Ankh and find sanctuary. And as part of this assignment, he has to pose as a runner, so much so that they change his life clock and take 6 years off of his life, and his hand starts flashing.
It's four, so, isn't it? I think it's 4 years.
Yeah, but... he's 36. Yeah, 4 years, because he says, I get those four years back, right?
Yeah.
So he ends up teaming up, trying to find the underground that can find sanctuary, which is this mythical place where runners go to get away from the society and to live past their 30-year deadline. Teams up with Jessica Six. They go through a series of adventures, which I'm sure we'll discuss.
Why do you think they call them Logan Five and Jessica Six? Because of the state they're in their life?
Well, they have to have more than one, because there are only four castes, and the castes are the green, red, blue, yellow. And so there would obviously be more Logans born at the same time, like per day, I would think. You wouldn't have, so that's why I think they have.
I would think there would be like Logan 600, not just Logan 5. But
well, remember, by the time you get to 30, Logan 1 is dead. So you can have another Logan 1.
Okay.
Then
I was curious about that.
They don't go into that in the novel either, by the way, the designation of the segmentation. But the novel's very different in the overall intent. I mean, one of the big things I wanted to talk about. And the difference is, in the novel, it's voluntary. You, at 30, you go to the sleep shop and you die, except it's 20 in the novel. 21, I think.
It's 21. Yeah. One of the differences. And they didn't want to have a cast of kids, so that's why they upped the age, is what I read.
Correct. Yeah. Which I have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. That works for me. And, yeah, you know, fine. The 20s are fairly hedonistic, so it should be. That works. But the whole intent of there is no renewal in, there's no carousel. There's none of that in the novel. The novel is this is the end of your life. It's society. You're helping out. You're doing
your last day.
You're doing your thing. It's last day. You go and do it sort of thing. Whereas in this, it's lottery day. And you have the chance and you have the option.
Well, they give you that idea that you have a chance, but no one's ever seen anybody survive it.
Correct. And did you think that was strong enough in the way they plotted this movie? That no one's ever been renewed, ever?
I don't think anything's strong enough in the way that they plotted this
movie. Okay. Ooh, cool. Well, let's go there. Let's talk about what was your first reaction to seeing this after so many years?
Well, the first time I saw this was on television, so it was edited. Mm-hmm. I never saw it in a theater. I'm pretty sure I rented it in the 80s on videotape and watched it again. And then last night, or the night before, was the last night or the last time I've ever seen it, the third time. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, you and I talked before we did this, and I said, you know what? I think I'm really going to like Logan's Run because it's been so long. Mm-hmm. And you know what? As far as bad movies go, it's a winner. I mean, it's got some great funny stuff in it. I mean, you can literally see them angry that their guns aren't really working the way they should be.
Yeah, because very few cops point their gun and then go.
But yeah, so I would say this is a deliciously bad movie with a pretty decent budget, as far as especially miniatures. The miniatures are beautiful in this movie. I could look at them forever.
Yeah, very Harryhausen kind of feel to it. I like all the miniature work.
Yeah, very Disney-esque too.
Early Disney-esque. Yep, I can see that.
So that's my impression. I think this is a great choice, Bug, and I'm glad you picked it because I enjoyed reacquainting myself with it. It had been a while.
Well, me too. And it's such a, quote, classic of the 70s kind of thing of this era when we're, you know, this was 76. This was the same time as Star Wars. It's
pre-Star Wars.
Yeah. And you're looking at it going, this was the state of science fiction at the time? Okay. All right. I can see that, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're talking about, like, some of the people associated with this because you've got, like, Saul David produced this.
Okay.
He was the same guy that had done Fantastic Voyage. I mean, so he knows good science fiction.
Right.
But that was 10 years earlier. But he also
knows to put women that are beautiful in skimpy outfits, too.
You say that as though it were a bad thing, Tim. I'm just saying. I want to know why when they do have the scene with Box, she has to get totally nude and Logan.
I want to know how they got their clothes back on so fast because I had to rewind it. I was like, there's no way they got dressed that fast.
Oh, yeah, there's no way they got dressed that fast. No.
But Michael Anderson directed this, and I didn't know anything about him. He did Around the World in 80 Days. Really his biggest thing. But he just died. He was 98 years old. He died in 2019 along with William F. Nolan.
He kept painting over his crystal so he could live longer.
Maybe
he
didn't
have to die. This was my reaction to it is very similar to yours. I think I wanted to like it much more than I did, and I think I wanted to remember it much more. I do think it's adequate, but nothing outstanding about it. And there are parts
of it that really piece.
It's a period piece.
It is. It's a period piece in the realm of science fiction.
There are things that really bug me about it from a storytelling perspective and from an execution perspective. And I think it's mostly production design. I think this movie would have been totally, even with the same script, I think this movie would have felt totally different with a different designer. Because it was so monochromatic for the lifestyle of the city. It's weird because in the movie it's a city, in the novel it's everywhere. It's society. It's the whole world. But
it's the fact that they all wear the same colors that drives me crazy, though. Like there was reds, greens, and like this peach color, and then the black outfits of the Sandman, and that's like it. I think I saw some children in yellow.
Well, there's red, yellow, green, blue. And the yellow is like this ochre-y, peachy. And I mean, the red is like this.
Well, they have red, but they also have this like peach color. I don't know. You see it when you go to Sanctuary because everybody's sitting there in it.
Right.
But
right.
It's weird. It's very strange.
Again, to my point, that is very monochromatic in the, you know, I do like the fact that they gave them different styles of that same color, you know, so people would wear a belt or they wouldn't wear a belt or it would be hanging down low or it would be tucked in or whatever. So there was some variety to that. But, you know, the set dressings and the design of Box and the design of the.
That's a horrible design.
Yeah, I just didn't like the design elements of it. I did always remember, even as a kid, that the guns were cool because they didn't fire a projectile. They kind of went and fire comes out of the end of it, and then something over there explodes. You know, so I thought that was kind of a way to save on opticals, but B, really kind of a cool weapon. I wanted that weapon that would shoot little flames out the end of it, kind of thing. But, you know, it's kind of like Kylo Ren's sword. It makes no sense. Why would you have glowing, you know, why would you have lightsaber edges coming out of the side of your freaking lightsaber?
It's weird.
So,
and I swear there are times when you could see them like shaking it, like they're pissed because it's not working.
Yeah, because I mean, my assumption, even as a kid, when I was watching this, you know, in high school and everything, I thought this was probably some kind of butane sort of device that does it, almost like a, you know. So they're having to shake it down so the liquid goes down. For the igniter.
I saw something or read something with Michael York where he said those goddamn blasters. I mean, he was like pissed because he said they all hated those guns because they never were.
And they never gave them a name. And that's, I think that's mostly because in the novel, it's called the gun. That's the clever name for their weapon. Not a blaster, not a phaser, not, it's the gun. You want to beware the gun.
Yeah. I want to touch on two more things in post or pre-production.
Yeah.
Before we move on to scenes. One is that the writer, other than the novel, which was, of course, Nolan and Johnson, was a guy named David Zelig Goodman, mm-hmm. who wrote the movie Straw Dogs, which I have added to our list because we're starting to do more thrillers now. And I think Straw Dogs is a good thriller.
Boy, is it.
He also wrote The Eyes of Laura Mars, which I came this close to watching last night so that I could do it as a genre topic, but I didn't mm-hmm. have enough time to watch it because it was co-written by John Carpenter and Barbara Streisand did the music and Faye Dunaway and Tommy Lee Jones are in it.
Faye Dunaway is the lead, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But anyway, I didn't watch it. But anyway, this guy that wrote this screenplay wrote that with John Carpenter. So I'm really curious to see it again. It's been ages since I've seen it. But the biggest thing as far as pre-production that I want to mention is that Jerry Goldsmith did the music.
Mm-hmm.
And Goldsmith is getting up there with us like directors we cover, like Robert Wise and other ones that we do multiple times. This is the fifth movie we've covered that Jerry Goldsmith did the music for. We also did Planet of the Apes, The Omen, Explorers, and Total Recall. And now
if you're 60s and 70s, you're going to have Goldsmith. He's going to be doing until Williams came along, really, you had Goldsmith was your go-to for science fiction. That's just what
clearly
everybody did. I also wanted to mention two others. So you mentioned the miniatures. The miniatures mm-hmm. were done by Frank Vanderveer and his company, and they're all really good. He's the same guy that did King Kong 76. He did all the special effects for it.
Oh, okay.
And he did Conan the Barbarian. He did a lot of the special effects for it, not the production design, but the special effects. So really good in this. And like we mentioned, the miniatures, even the tubes, the little tube transport monorails and all that was really cool. But I also wanted to mention the makeup. The makeup in this, both the normal makeup and anything else, like Peter Ustinov's makeup and everything else, is done by William Tuttle. And as soon as it came up, I went, Tuttle. Why do I know that name? He started as an assistant makeup artist for The Wizard of Oz.
Oh my gosh.
But he's also credited with Forbidden Planet, The Time Machine. He designed the Morlocks. Eye of the Beholder.
You had me with Morlock.
Twilight Zone, Eye of the Beholder, the episode where everybody's ugly and the girl's beautiful, the reverse kind of negative thing.
Yeah.
And his last movie that he did makeup for was Young Frankenstein. What a career this dude had.
That's Frankenstein, David.
Frankenstein. But so what a career. That's really pretty, pretty interesting. I thought it was pretty.
Do you know anything about how Michael Anderson I guess he chose Goodman to do the screenplay, ended up with this? Because this movie, this was not the first time this movie was attempted.
No, I didn't do research. I didn't find that in research. What?
Okay, yeah. George Pal owned it at one time.
Mm.
And Irwin Allen owned it at one time. But those rights lapsed. And at one time, I read where Roger Corman was trying to get it.
Interesting.
But dude, MGM would not let him have it. MGM owned it.
So. Now, I think it would have been interesting if Irwin Allen had done it. I think. But this has an Irwin Allen feel to it, don't you think?
It has a 70s television feel to me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much. Again, a problem I have with the production design of this mm-hmm. is this feels like television.
It feels like Space 1999 or something.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Sadly true. Yes. Scenes, I guess.
Yeah. Well, Sanctuary would be my first scene because I had forgotten about it. I was like, okay, they're in red robes and wearing hockey masks. And then they, you know, it starts going around and they start floating up. And I was like, and this is another television science fiction thing. They explode, but basically it's just a shower of sparks.
Yes.
Superimposed over them and some smoke and they're gone. There's no blood or anything. It's just oof.
The opticals in this movie are pretty bad all the way through. I mean, some of the pyro works when they actually have a charge explode on somebody's back or beside somebody when they're shooting, but all of the carousel pyro, the pyro.
Oh, I mean, Sanctuary. I'm sorry. Did I say Sanctuary? I meant Carousel.
You meant Carousel.
Yeah, I meant Carousel.
I knew what you meant. We all knew. We watched it. We watched the weird Jason hockey mask things and the weird float in the air, blow up unitards. And then you've got, but all the opticals at the end too, when supposedly the whole city's being destroyed and things are falling and they're
superimposing. That's the Irwin Allen part.
Yeah, that and the whole box destruction with the ice falling and barely superimposed people in the back. It's just terrible effects. It's not really very dated for the time, I guess.
Yeah. Carousel's a scene.
I would agree with you with Carousel. I always remember, I remember the key big, the key sequences. I always remember the Jessica scene because it's the only time she wears that particular costume, which has no sides. The one that's
not got a side on it.
Yeah, no sides, which, of course, as a young teen boy, I remembered and went, yes, why does society not endorse this sort of clothing? I don't understand why this isn't standard.
Yeah, but Jenny Agutter hated her costumes in this movie. I'm sure she did.
But that was an interesting scene showing the callousness of Logan, I thought, and his just... because even the way it ends, I mean, he doesn't really care about her. She actually leaves. Francis comes in with two other girls. They throw the drug fog and just, decide to have an orgy kind of
thing. Is that what that was? Drug fog?
Well, it's what I called it.
Because I was wondering what it was. I was like, why is all that smoke coming in?
Well, later on in the chase scene, they have the whole fog sequence that they run through and they're all kind of high and orgasmic and they run into the big.
All right. I guess I didn't pick up on that.
So I just called it the drug fog. But, he had a drug fog ball that he did. But I remembered that one. I remember even at the time when I watched it originally, I loved the concept of box, but I thought the dialogue was horrible and I thought the design was terrible.
The design is so bad.
Oh my gosh, it's bad. It's bad Doctor Who.
You're right. It's not even good Doctor Who because the mask is clearly a mirrored plastic and you can see his face behind it. It's just not good. You can see his mouth moving behind
his
robot mouth.
The arms of that particular robot only have limited access. How is he going to be a threat or scare you or anything? So that didn't work for me. The whole destruction of him didn't work for me. All the underground stuff didn't work for me. I did, however, like it once they finally get to, they go past the Planet of the Apes scenes and get to the Capitol.
There's so many sci-fi keys in this movie.
Oh my gosh.
I'm typing them as we speak.
But I think Peter Ustinov is one of the best roles he's ever had. I think he's great.
He hasn't had that many good ones, but I would agree with you there.
I think he is so great in that kind of pseudo absent-minded. He plays him sort of goofy, but doesn't go over the edge with him. And I really like that. There's a lot of, although once we get to it, I don't understand the ending at all, but
it's happy, David. Everybody's happy.
While he's being mobbed, I just think, what if they start tearing pieces off of him to keep? I don't understand.
Oh, they have to touch him.
Yeah.
He's
old.
Touch
the old man. Touch
it. Other costumes are pink now that I think about it, because there's one behind me. You see the red next to the pink. It's like red, pink, green, and yellow and black.
Yep.
It's very strange. Anyway.
One of the lines I've got is... that I wanted to discuss with you is do you, what did they call it? Hold on. Let me see if I can find it real quick.
Do you prefer women?
No. Do you know who your seed? Do you know who the seed mother was?
The seed mother?
The seed mother. That's what she asks. Do you know who the seed mother was? Because they're trying to get this Brave New World concept, which is what a lot of this is influenced. That's a big key for this movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're separated at birth. You never know your parents. You never know your... And then the other one, both of those, I think, are Jessica lines. And there's another Jessica that I have that says, do those cracks in your face hurt?
That was funny. That made me laugh.
Yeah. I like it. Any other scenes for you?
Well, I would definitely say the ice cave, just because I thought it was really cool that they all think they're going to get to Sanctuary and there's a robot there that's freezing them. It makes no sense, but it was cool, especially as a kid, to see that. And that explains why Peter Ustinov is still predominantly alone, because most of the runners get frozen.
Well, according to Logan, all of them have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everyone who has tried Box has frozen.
Which is unbelievable, period, because Box is so cumbersome and so clumsy that, I mean, they get by him very easily.
Right. And I don't, I do love the whole concept, the sci-fi concept of a misfunctioning robot who's just doing his purpose.
Right.
Kind of thing, you know, but it was not threatening and it didn't work and we didn't have enough time. And also it didn't make sense coming from this big swim in the ocean, climb underground staircase sequence to suddenly get to an elevator that goes to the Arctic.
Can we talk about sets?
Yeah, the repurpose of sets.
I was going to say the reason a lot of the sets look great is they're real places.
Yep.
Like when they go down that long staircase, that's in the MGM like warehouses. And then they had a lot of stuff was shot on location in Dallas. And they like the complex they live in. I was like, that looks like a shopping mall to me. I kept thinking of Dawn of the Dead. And it was actually a mart. In Dallas, where people did go to shop or to buy goods to sell in shops. And then the tunnels, I mean, not the tunnel scene, when they get out of the water filtration place or whatever, and there's all these like pipes going forever. That was like some kind of real plant. Like,
yeah,
they lucked out with a lot of their sets because they didn't have to build them.
The finale ending and those waterworks and everything else is another museum kind of place in Texas.
Yeah.
That's where all of that was. All the
waterworks. It's wild that they filmed a lot of this movie in Dallas. I guess they scouted locations and that's why they ended up there.
Yeah. And maybe they could have gotten tax credits at the time or something that would have, you know, been better to film there rather than Los Angeles.
And wasn't Farrah Fawcett from Texas? It seems maybe. Like she was.
scenes. I think that's all I've got for.
Well, yeah. I mean, the two I can think of the most are Carousel and the ice caves. You're naturally going to think of his quarters because that's where she's wearing that costume. And then the only thing else that comes to mind is just Richard Jordan being so over the top with the wide, crazy eyes. But that's not really a scene. That's just bad performance.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of skipped over the Cubs. And the whole, when they went to Cathedral and the Cubs are there, which is where they're basically where this society throws their criminals is if you can't live by the rules, you have to live in Cathedral kind of thing. But that could have been a really scary kind of, imagine a John Carpenter take on that scene would have been really good.
Yeah.
But
that was the Miri section.
Yeah.
From Star
That's
Trek.
That's exactly how I have it. It's mirrors. Yeah.
That's because we think alike.
Yep. We've also got the laser doctor, the new face guy, that sequence.
Oh, yeah. And that guy's played by somebody we know, isn't he?
And that is Farrah's scene, basically.
Oh, yeah. Other you know what? It's Farrah I'm thinking of. Right.
That's Farrah's big scene, other than showing up at Cathedral and saying, you know, for the underground. Kind of thing. And then the only other scene is the control scenes. So I do remember liking those and thinking those are really cool. And they heavily influenced my amateur, you know, filmmaking, mine and Wynn's amateur filmmaking of sci-fi projects for like a decade after that.
I'm sure the y'all had like blaster squibs.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. But the whole sitting in the chair and the screen with the female computer voice and the, you know, the tubes coming down with the holographic images of his head spinning around and all that. That was kind of a cool concept at the time. And that was kind of different and very sci-fi. And we kind of liked that.
Okay. I know why, and I'll get to this in casting, but I know why I recognize the doctor. It's because it's Michael Anderson, the director.
Oh, yeah. That's why. Yep.
That.
And he did a lot of television. He did, I think he's got a lot of credits for, you know, Westerns and some television in the 60s and 70s.
But that's Farrah Sane. For all of you that don't know, Farrah Fawcett Majors was in this movie. It was around the time she was doing Charlie's Angels. But I was like, man, she must have had an acting coach because she is awful in this.
Yeah.
She is so bad. I was like, ooh, she's good thing you're pretty. Yes, this is not good.
And they were lucky to get Michael York. He's good in this, actually.
Yeah, Michael York's great. I was kind of curious about him. We'll get to casting, though, in a second. But I'm assuming we're done with scenes, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can go on to casting. That's, I guess, what we would do next.
Do the cast.
Yeah, Michael York's British. He's a Shakespearean actor. This movie, by the way, should have been filmed in England, not in Texas. Because every single person in it is British except for Richard Jordan. Well, I mean, Farrah Fawcett's not, but she's got a very tiny part. Michael York is a Shakespearean actor. He played Lucentio in Taming the Shrew. He played Tybalt in Romeo and Juliet, both directed by Franco Zeffirelli. He claims his biggest mistake in life was turning down the role of Ryan O'Neill played in Love Story. Did you know that?
Yeah, I did.
I didn't know that, but that makes sense because that movie did make Ryan O'Neill a movie star. And Michael York, I always think of him as in sci-fi movies like this and the remake of Island of Dr. Moreau and things like that.
He also did a Babylon 5 episode that was really good. He actually played King Arthur, or supposedly played King Arthur. It was very ambiguous in the story. It was really cool kind of thing. Yeah, I've always associated with him with science fiction.
Did you know that this reminds me of you making movies again, that he broke his nose at the age of 3 when he jumped off the roof of a house?
You have to do that for the shot. You got to do it.
I just think about our friend Steve Roy broke his arm jumping off a roof. But ever since this, I mean, he almost turned down this role because he didn't feel like he was right for the role. He did it, and it was a big hit. But he is more known as a lot of the actors that we see in these genre pieces now as being a voice actor. So he's a very prolific voice actor. He's got a great voice. He's Shakespearean, and that makes perfect sense.
Well, I remember him because he played Basil Exposition in all the Austin Power movies. He was essentially the M character, the boss kind of thing.
Right, right. And he's perfect for that role.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He's got a great accent. His accent works really strongly. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I also always think of him in Cabaret with Liza Minnelli.
Oh, yeah.
That's another big role he did. Richard Jordan, on the other hand, I don't know how he got this gig. I think he's a little over the top. We know him from The Hunt for Red October. He was in the Dune movie that we watched, David Lynch did.
Yes.
And then I know him mostly from Rich Man, Poor Man, which was a miniseries he did with Nick Nolte, I believe.
I think he won an Emmy for that.
I can't remember.
I think he actually was. He was at least nominated, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he was not the original choice for that. Did you know that?
No. Who would you?
This was already cast with someone else that had to drop out. William Devane was cast in that role. And I like William Devane. I think of him from stupid things like Knots Landing, but he was also in like a Kennedy miniseries where he played JFK. Devane had to withdraw from the project because he got cast to replace Roy Thinnes in Alfred Hitchcock's Family Plot.
Oh, well.
And you know, I mean, I don't know which is worse, Logan Trone or Family Plot. They're both pretty bad.
Yep. Yep.
I would say that this made more money than Family Plot, though. Jenny Agutter played Jessica. Oh, by the way, Richard Jordan's character's name is Frances. Jenny Agutter played Jessica. I didn't really know much about her, except for you always talking about how hot she is. She is. Oh, she's also British and she's also Shakespearean. I knew I had something about Shakespeare.
Yes.
She was in American Werewolf. I just haven't seen that movie in a very long time. So that's maybe why I don't remember her.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember her from Avengers?
I don't, but I read that she was in it.
She was in my favorite. She was in Winter Soldier. She's the councilwoman. She's actually in the other Avengers.
Avengers movie.
Whenever Nick Fury is talking to the council on the big screens.
Yeah, she's one of them. Okay.
Yeah.
I figured that's what it was because I do have that in my notes. Their first choices for the roles of Logan and Jessica. Want to take a wild guess?
Sure.
Never get it.
No, I wouldn't want to imagine in 76 what that could possibly be.
John Voight and Lindsay Wagner.
My God. Speaking of television, let's just go. Well,
John
there.
Voight's a movie actor, but Lindsay Wagner
not
is
really.
Straight out
he
of
wants
television.
To be, but yeah, no. Yeah. No, that would have been.
Yeah, I good. Have to say, I'm much more like Michael York and Jenny Agutter than those two, for sure.
Yeah, their coup d'etat in this one is definitely getting those two as your principals because they could make some of that inane dialogue really work.
Yeah. I wish the script had been stronger because some of the lines they read make them look ridiculous. So,
yes.
Let's see. They also had appeared in a movie together before or later, excuse me. They were in The Riddle of the Sands and they were also in September 1979 and 1996. So, okay. I don't know any of those movies. They may be British movies. Yep. Roscoe Lee Brown played Box, the clunky robot in the ice cave. I know him best. I mean, first of all, he was a television actor and any black sitcom like Good Times or The Jeffersons, you normally would see Roscoe Lee Brown on as a guest star. I know him best from The Cowboys, that John Wayne movie.
Yes. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. He played Jebediah and I was a big John Wayne fan as a kid. I watched all those movies and that's the one about where he's like corralling all the kids that are, that's why it's called The Cowboys.
Yeah, and Roscoe Lee Brown's character was the cook that went with them. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's what I know him for. As I said, no one else wanted to be in this movie, so other than those that John Voight and Lindsay Wagner and William Devane. Farrah Fawcett Majors plays Holly, the surgical assistant to Michael Anderson. She, of course, was in Charlie's Angels. She was an enormous sex symbol at the time because of the famous poster where you see a little bit of nipple action under the one-piece swimsuit.
Had it. Yep.
This is not the only science fiction movie she did. Do you remember the other one?
She did
Saturn III. Kirk Douglas.
Kirk Douglas.
Which I immediately went to our list and made sure it was on there because I need to see that movie.
Yep. Yep.
It was 4 years later, so maybe she got some coaching by then. Well, from what I understand, she got cast because of Michael York. That Michael York was playing tennis when he saw, quote, a blonde vision of delight. It turned out to be Farrah Fawcett, and he suggested her to the casting director, and she landed the role. So that's how she got in it, because like I said, she's very pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Anderson, the director, was Doc. Yep. He was also in a John Wayne movie, The Sons of Katie Elder, which is another really good John Wayne movie. You mentioned Peter Ustinov played the old man. I was like, why do I know him? I know that name. So I looked him up and he was in Spartacus and he was in Death on the Nile. But neither one of those are big movies with me. I know Spartacus was a pretty big movie, but.
Anyway. It was pretty huge for Kubrick. Yeah.
His role was offered just to an American, though, and that American turned it down. Any guesses?
No.
James Cagney.
Yeah,
I love James Cagney. He's a great actor.
I like James Cagney, but I don't see him doing that, but could be. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Anyway, I don't have any other on casting. Everything else is a minor role or a background character. I did have. Oh, this movie was. Remember, I told you it was attempted to be made other times besides this one. Mm-hmm. One of those productions was in 1969 with Robert Redford. I don't know. I mean, it would have been interesting. It might have been better for all we know, because 69 was a good year for sci-fi.
It was, but it would have totally depended on the script again.
Right. And the director. Yeah.
Which are my major issues with this is I don't think they know what they're wanting to tell and say thematically.
I think they're trying to do it. I think they're trying to immerse you in the world. And you know how we like that, you know, being thrown into something not really knowing. But to me, the lines are really gimmicky. You know, like you said, Seed Mother and that kind of stuff. It didn't work for me.
No, that doesn't work. But I also don't think there's thematics underneath it. What are they trying to say? This society was built to always have eternal youth. That was the thing. Why? Why do we always
need because they're apparently survivors of a Holocaust of some sort.
Yeah. Obviously, this was, you know, a minor. This is that dystopian sort of storytelling of an idyllic world that's actually a facade for something else, you know, sort of thing, which we'll get to, I'm sure, with Keys and everything else. But I think the big issue is this basically turns out to be like a video game. It's basically X number of puzzles or adventures they have to have to get to the next one. And they don't interconnect. We go from underwater urban world to ice planet to we're outside frolicking in the pool to suddenly we're in D.C. at the Capitol. And it's
Logan is a pretty zealous Sandman. I don't buy his transition at all. All of a sudden he's, I'm leaving. I'm like, wait a minute. You were what?
Curious that you bring that up. One of the big differences between the novel and this is in the novel, he actually agrees to it. He actually says, then if I want to find sanctuary, I need to go undercover. So he's more of a better cop, less kind of frilly, fun-loving guy like this. Mm-hmm. He's more of a, then I can help by going undercover and trying to find the underground, and we'll destroy sanctuary that way. In this one, he's kind of forced into it because the computer literally takes 4 years off him and says, you are a runner now, whether you want to be or not.
Right.
And I wish there had been more of that, because I like that better than the hard-boiled cop saying, I'll go undercover. I like much better the, I'm forced into it.
Well, but the transition to me is still clunky.
Clunky,
And then the transition of their relationship is clunky. I don't buy that they really like each other.
And that doesn't, you mean Francis?
No, Francis is just crazy. No, I'm talking about Jessica and Logan.
Yeah.
I don't buy their relationship.
Logan doesn't do anything to me that would make Jessica A, fall in love with him, B, like him, B, want to be his, redeem himself, show a character trait, something. He doesn't do something that, I totally agree with you, that would make the character of Jessica suddenly go, maybe he is a different kind of Sandman.
Exactly. And they never show that. But she has that reaction, like he is a great guy. And I'm like, okay.
Well, again, if I remember correctly, in the novel, something happens in Cathedral. There's a thing that happens with the Cubs, like with one of the little girls or something like that, that Jessica imprints on with Logan.
He like does Kirk something like with Mary. They could have done that and it would have worked.
Yeah. It's kind of like you're supposed to buy that because he let the one girl go, Jessica sees that he's really a good guy. But they don't play that up enough. And immediately when she's gone, Francis runs up and shoots her.
And shoots her immediately. She doesn't live very long at all. And you're right. They actually do play it up. It's just clunky.
It doesn't work. Yeah.
It doesn't work. And it's like, you need to buy this. And I'm like, I'm not in the market for that.
Yeah. And all of it would work if they had kept the ending. One of my biggest changes from the novel, if they had kept the ending from the novel, which is they all, because in the novel, Sanctuary is not on Earth anywhere. So there is a sanctuary. It's on Mars. It's on a satellite of Mars. Oh. And that is where they have to get to. So they're actually at a jet port trying to get passage onto this ship. Because remember, it's the whole world. It's the whole world. You're not just suddenly roaming through Planet of the Apes world. You're actually, you know, in the society. But, and Francis finally catches them and then reveals that he has actually been this guy that they, you know, haven't talked about in forever, but he has been part of the underground for like the past 10 years. And he's been helping runners escape. He's actually faked his life clock and he's actually in his 40s. And he's actually been pushing Logan and Jessica to get away. And they do get away. They escape society and everything and win. And Francis goes back to helping more runners. And that would have been a really cool way to do it rather than, oh, Logan's going to beat his best friend to death.
Well, or him do that crazy leap off of that thing. I was like, no one could jump from something that high up.
No.
And the only reason he does it is because in a very brief shot before that, Jessica grabs his gun and throws it. I had to go back and rewind it to watch that because I was like, when did he lose his gun?
Yeah. Yeah. I even have in my notes, where is his gun? When did he lose it? You know, why doesn't he have it kind of thing? But I do think it would have added, and it may have given Richard Jordan more pullback if he had been more of a, you know, a co-conspirator kind of thing rather than a maniacal killer who's got to kill Logan for no reason, even though they were bestest friends having orgy sex 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
For as much as we've trashed this movie, would you believe that it was nominated for Academy Awards?
No, for what?
It was nominated for 2 Academy Awards. It was nominated for cinematography and art direction.
The two that I hate in this. The lighting
and guess
is
what?
Horrible.
I'm not done.
No.
It got an Academy Award. For special achievement in visual effects.
Sure.
1 year before Star Wars.
Yeah, those miniatures and those pump guns worked so well.
I think it was before they had the award. So I think it was like a precursor to adding that award as a regular award. That's why it's called special achievement.
I mean, give it to the matte paintings or DC. Those aren't bad. And the miniatures we've already agreed are good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the opticals all the way through this movie are terrible. Even the title opticals are terrible.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. The Academy of Sci-Fi, Fantasy, and Horror awarded it 5. Best science fiction film, cinematography, art direction, set decoration, and costumes. So it won 5 Saturn Awards. The Hugos did not give it anything, but they nominated it for Best Dramatic Presentation. And this is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you
It's
die.
Not? I am stunned.
Stunned. Just like being shot by one of those blasters, those defective blasters.
Do you know what else came out in 76? The Man Who Fell to Earth.
That's Nicholas Rogue.
Yeah, and David Bowie.
And much better.
Yeah, and much. I was just about to say that.
Well, it's not. And it doesn't rely on a lot of special effects. It more relies on the narrative. But yeah.
Well, yeah, it's much more of an in-depth personal study sort of story. Mm-hmm. And it works. This is much more bombastic, bigger.
Well, average. This is much more entertaining because it's got action and stuff in it.
Sure. Yeah.
Nicholas Rogue's, it's a decent movie. It's worth covering, but if I remember right, it's a little bit of a slog. Before we move on to Keys, did you have any trivia or anything else you wanted to talk about?
Let me check real quick, but I do not think so. Trivia. No, I mean, I think that I don't have any outstanding trivia.
Well, there was one when the old man is showing Logan some of the pictures that hang on the wall in the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
There was at one point a President Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a line of the old man saying they used to call him Tricky. And they cut it because they thought it was too controversial at the time.
Yeah, but the orgy scenes aren't. They're good. They're fine.
So that was, 3 years after Watergate? Maybe four? I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway. And then the love shop sequence, as you mentioned, originally ran around 4 minutes, but they had to re-edit it to get a PG rating. Although there is nudity in this movie, if you look carefully. Yeah.
There is.
Yep. Not just Jenny's costumes, but also the sex scenes and stuff.
In the sex scenes.
Arcade.
Yep.
And
obviously there are no bras in the future, you know, because if you watch even all of them walking,
they're jiggly. Yeah.
Carousel and everything else. No one is wearing, you know, a bra.
Yeah. So. I noticed that. And as a gay man noticing it, you know, it's prominent.
So, yeah,
I was like, they're not wearing bras. And then one last thing I noticed at the very end. Did you notice that somebody flashes the Live Long and Prosper sign at the end?
No, I mean, the hand looks like it's doing
it's definitely there.
Okay.
I mean, I went back and looked for it. It's the very, very end when Peter Ustinov's getting like mobbed by all the young people.
Yeah.
Somebody in the crowd like raises a hand and it's in that position. I was like, okay.
Okay.
There's nice a Trekkie in there, a Trekker.
Yeah. Trekkie extras. I love it.
They're trying to connect the worlds.
I do have in my watch notes, I've got, okay, I love the female computer voice. The scary female computer voice is cool.
I liked it too.
I also have, if you have transporters, why do you have tubes? Because she transports to his apartment. You know, he turns on the wall thing, and first the one guy appears, and then he goes away, and then suddenly she appears and steps out. And I'm going, yeah, if you have transporters, why would you have tubes? Makes no freaking sense.
Need them.
You know,
nah. They look cool.
Yeah. I wouldn't believe that to interrogation at all. He's lying. What is up with Box? I'm just looking at all my
watch notes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How could you possibly go back through all of that? Everything was destroyed as you left it, including Box's lair. That's an unbelievable return. Why didn't they just have the flying guys come and get him? Because, you know, they have the guys on the scooters.
Decomposed the bodies. That was so weird.
Yeah, a nice little touch, but then nothing happened, and you didn't do anything with it.
Yeah, it's like rapid decomposition, and then the mush that's left just vanishes. I was like, wow, well, that's easy cleanup.
And they get to that finale interrogation scene, and Kirk is more believable in his battles with computers than Logan is in this interrogation with this computer.
But Dave...
The whole point was, it doesn't believe that he's telling the truth when he says there's no sanctuary. And I was going, if that's it, dude, that's really where you're going with this? You're doing Star Trek like times five that they did in the original series where you outsmart Landru and everything else. That's what you're doing for your finale for this? But. That's what they
did. And I thought the whole idea of them going back is stupid. First, you wouldn't go because why would you want to risk being caught and put to death, which is basically what happened. And then they escape really easy because it's like a Batman scenario where, you know, oops, we got caught, but we'll escape, and they get out. You know, I'll grab a blaster and start shooting. Yeah. I'm Luke Skywalker.
I'll shoot everything, everybody. Shoot it all.
Right. Keys.
Okay. Of course you got to go with... You have the novel, of course. You have to go with the basics of sci-fi literature at the turn of the century. So you have to go with 1984. You have to go with Brave New World, especially. Walden 2, Fahrenheit 451. All those dystopian views of society that truly
got an issue underneath it and nobody realizes it. I think overall, the biggest one for that would be Brave New World for this
one. I agree. And what did you say, Walden 2? What is
Walden 2? Walden 2 is the one that it's Thoreau's version of Utopia. Very organic, very
tree huggery. Oh, you're talking about Walden. I thought you were using the number 2.
Walden. Yeah, but Walden 2 is the novel that he talks about this society that has collective sharing of parenting, and we live in the trees and we love nature and we coexist with the animals and nature and everything. It's a very...
Who wrote that?
Thoreau.
Thoreau wrote Walden.
Yes, but he also wrote Walden. I'm pretty sure he also wrote Walden. I could look it up real quick.
You know, I've never heard of that. Thoreau was like a literary writer that wrote a travel narrative or what I would call environmental. Okay,
so maybe I was wrong about the author, maybe a bit. But actually, you'll recognize the author.
But there could have been a Walden 2 that was written by some sci-fi novelist. I just am familiar with Walden, the Thoreau work, and that is it's utopian.
It's written by B.F. Skinner, the big psychotherapist. Yep, and his it was his take on society without technology.
All right, I'm going to put that in the keys because I'm curious about that.
Well, I'm curious if anyone else out there has read it or knows it or whatever.
Yeah, I was going to say Thoreau was not writing science fiction or dystopian stuff. Well,
he did in his spare time, Tim. You just didn't read it.
He was in a cabin by a lake writing about beavers.
Yeah, beavers with his coffee.
Yes. Mm. What else? This spawned a television series. We were talking about television science fiction.
And I have never seen it.
I don't know if I ever watched it or not. It only lasted one season, 77.
I never watched one episode of it. Nope.
And then one of my biggest things when I was talking about the miniatures is that it reminds me of two things that are Disney related. One is the Tomorrowland Transit Authority, where you're going through Space Mountain and they have that model of Epcot and that little miniature model of what Walt thought Epcot would look like. It looks exactly like the Logan's Run city. But then also the hotel, the Contemporary, right next to Disney World, or should I say the Magic Kingdom, has a monorail that goes through it. Mm-hmm. So that's very similar to this design aesthetic. Well, and also
way Contemporary looks with that kind of truncated side pyramid.
Triangle. Yeah.
Design. Oh, yeah. It looks very, very much like
so this. A lot of the visuals of this remind me of Disney World.
Yep. I agree with that. I've got, we mentioned Planet of the Apes, of course. You mentioned Miri, which was very similar. Yeah, that Star Trek episode. I also think there's a lot of Barbarella inspiration to this. You know, just in the pseudo sexy design, a lot of chrome. Our version of the future has this weird kind of plastic tubes and kind of aesthetic, I guess.
Well, but with Barbarella, a lot of the humor was intentional.
Yes. In this, not so much.
Not so much.
And I have two. I have three more. I think a huge key to this is Minority Report. Because, again, it's a police officer who realizes that what he's been doing is actually wrong when he is suddenly thrust into the story. And suddenly he's accused of something, and now he has to run and try to prove his innocence or change society sort of thing. So I thought that was a big influence on this, or influenced on by this. My biggest one is, and I would love for somebody out there to challenge me if you don't, because I couldn't find another one. I think this may have been the huge impetus for YA sci-fi novels. This whole idyllic, youthful version of
I could see that.
Because you've got Maze Runner, Divergent, even Handmaid's
Hunger
Tale. Hunger Games.
Hunger Games is a death thing, too, where they're going to die. Yeah.
A lottery. Duh. Literally a lottery. And I'm sure there are a dozen others that I never read nor want to, or sort of thing. But that whole subgenre of sci-fi being YA, young adult societies sort of thing. I thought that was, and in my last one is Time Machine, which, you know, when they go to the future, only the young are there. That's the society.
And what are they called? Because they remind me of those people.
The Eloi, I think.
Eloi's, yes.
Eloi. Yeah.
It's the Eloi's and the Morlocks. And Morlocks. That was one of my keys, and I forgot to write it down, is that these people, like when they go back and they're trying to convince them that they need to come, they just turn around and keep walking. I'm like, they're as dumb as those blonde-headed guys in the time machine.
There you go. Perfect. Yeah. And it's true. Yeah, I agree.
I have several others. As far as aesthetics, again, Metropolis, the city design in Metropolis. As far as running around with blasters, Star Wars, because they're always running around with blasters in Star Wars. 70s sci-fi TV, we mentioned. The one that particularly came to mind was Space 1999, but you could also lump like Planet of the Apes, the series in there and stuff. We briefly mentioned Planet of the Apes, but there's a huge Planet of the Apes key in this when they finally get outside and you realize that it is pretty much the same world. It's just been decayed because of a nuclear, whatever.
Yeah.
Catastrophic event. I've got Lost in Space because Box is very similar to the robot with those arms that spin.
Well, and also the Doc's lab with all of those buttons and two, that's a very Lost in Space set with just black behind them, no walls, and all these control panels that he can fiddle with.
Yeah.
That's very Lost in Space.
Yeah. And I also had 2001 because of the computer being menacing. And
that's
basically
a good one. Yeah,
because at one point he says, will I get those years back? And it doesn't say anything. It just stays blank.
Yep.
It's like very suspenseful. And then I have a few that are on IMDb. There's an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation called Half a Life. Do you remember that?
Where vaguely people are,
what?
Vaguely. It's that same euthanasia story.
Right. They have to reach resolution, which is mandatory suicide at age 60.
Oh, yeah, that's a really, really, really good episode. That could have been, that's much better than this. David Ogden Stiers plays the lead in it. And he decides to buck his society. And he says, no, I don't want to do it. And it has a hugely tragic, excellent ending. You know, by that same token, what's the other one? The one in Menior 7, you know, where they have to go into the disintegration chambers.
I don't know Next Generation.
No, this is Classic Trek.
Oh,
remember they beam down and they have the computers are plotting the war between a Menior and Vendikar. And if
that's first season.
Yeah. Yeah. Taste of Armageddon. Taste of Armageddon.
Yeah. Taste of Armageddon. Yeah. I remember that.
And, you know, your number came up, so you have to walk into the
machine. Yeah, exactly. You're dead.
Going to the sleep shop. It's my last day. Hey.
There's also apparently a new movie, newer movie. It came out in 2017 that I know nothing about, called What Happened to Monday?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great novel. I mean, great movie.
We need to make sure that's on our list.
Is a really good one. You're okay. Right.
It says an overcrowded society only allows one child per family, forcing any subsequent siblings to go into cryo sleep. Yeah. However, it turns out they're actually disposed of.
Yeah, there's no cryo sleep.
Okay. And then, of course, Soylent Green.
Soylent Green,
That's voluntary euthanasia, but it's still a sci-fi movie from 1973 that has the same concept. And then for some reason I have Westworld down, maybe because it's MGM.
Yeah. And this has that same kind of look. They used to say, look, they could have used the same kind of camera and lensing in this because it looks like television.
Oh, I know why. You know? The reason it got made is because of the success of Soylent Green and Westworld. That's why it got made. Cause they both came out in 1973 and this came out in 76.
Well, you go ahead.
Oh no, I thought you were done. Go ahead.
I've got Doctor Who. Of course, because we mentioned it, it's especially Box is a very Doctor Who kind of feel to it.
It sure does.
But I also have what I call the Roddenberry pilot vehicles. Planet Earth and Genesis 2 were two movies that he made for television. I think it was NBC, but he's trying to get a new franchise started. And they're both in a future society where the entire planet is connected by these tubes. These big, huge, which is what the transportation reminded me of. But, you know, naturally you go to one civilization that's left on Earth, and it's all a matriarchy with really, really sexy, gorgeous women who are using all the men as slaves, and they're feeding them drugs to keep them dumb and all that. So, yeah, very Roddenberry kind of feel to it.
The only one I have left is the scene in the facelift shop where they go to change
new face.
Mm-hmm. It's where the laser runs them up.
Yeah.
Was copied in the movie Die Another Day, the James Bond movie.
Oh yeah, with the big laser, multi-laser arms.
Right.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about that. That's a good one.
That's all I have.
That's all I have. That's all we have.
This one ran a little long. I wasn't expecting that.
Wow. But we would love to know what you guys think. Buck, thank you so much, A, for supporting Johnny Has the Keys, but also for giving us a suggestion. We do take your guys' suggestions, and we put them into seasons and hopefully talk about them. We'd love to know what you guys think. Do you like Logan's Run? What is its legacy in science fiction? How do you feel about it? Did it work? Did it not? You know, it kind of worked for us in ways, but not really.
I still think it's, nostalgically speaking, it's a major landmark in sci-fi, especially 70s sci-fi.
Yeah. And right before Star Wars changed science fiction forever,
right,
kind of thing. So, but we'd love to know what you guys think. You can feel free to leave a comment down below. Also, we would love a review, a star, all the good things that you can do for us. Subscribe and ring the bell. That way you get to know when we're doing new episodes and what's coming and all that. And if you do want to support us and help us like Buck does, you can become a patron for our show. And by that, once you give as much as, what is it, a cup of coffee a month, you say?
There's different tiers. Some of them are mm-hmm. free. Some of them are $2 and one. The $5 tier monthly is the one that's the cup of coffee a month or whatever. And that's the one that will get you our bonus, or not bonus, but our secondary shows on Star Trek and the X-Files. But we have bonus shows and other shows on there for free as well. So,
yeah. And we'd love to hear from you. Leave your comments down below. Tell us what you like, what you didn't, what you want to see. And Tim, I guess next time we'll see each other doing something different.
Yeah, I believe we're going back into the world of Richard Matheson. So,
Nice. Well, I'll see you then.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.